Chapter 20. After everything they'd been through in the past 24 hours, including a trip on a jet from Austria to Northern Africa, their next step, ironically, would be flying the same jet back to Austria. "It's called Lake Toplitz," Lewis said. He was using Duckworth's laptop, connected to the jet's onboard internet. "The closest airport is Salzburg." Duckworth got up to tell the pilot about the next destination. Nick and Kate came over to join the conversation. "I've heard of Lake Toplitz," Nick said. "There was a Nazi naval station there during the war," Lewis said. "It's a very deep lake, very secluded. They tested depth charges there. Maybe torpedoes, too. They also used it as a sort of dumping station. Like when they printed 100,000 pounds worth of counterfeit notes for Operation Bernhardt. When they scuttled that plan, they dumped all of the notes in the lake. Some people think you can even find sunken aircraft if you go all the way to the bottom. There's even a legend that there's a flying saucer down there." "And gold?" Nick asked. Lewis nodded. "All part of the legend. Maybe we're about to prove it's really true. At least the gold part. But what makes this lake the deep well of the Iron Man?" Kate asked. "Goering had a villa nearby," Lewis said. "It was his favorite place in the world, and he spent as much of his free time there as he could. Out of all the Nazi leaders, he was the one man most surprised when he was found guilty of war crimes at Nuremberg. He must have believed he would just retire to Lake Toplitz, live out the rest of his life there." "With his own personal stash of gold," Nick said, "after he sold out everyone else." "You can leave gold in water forever," Lewis said, "where it never degrades. And Toplitz is still very isolated. Even today, the nearest public road is a mile away from the lake." "Well, we still have one problem," Nick said. "Once again, Agar knows the same thing we know. It's going to be a race to get there first." "He thought he was untouchable in the Western Sahara," Jake said. "But if he comes to Austria, we can take him, hold him for Interpol." Kate shook her head. "If we tell Interpol that we think the gold's at the bottom of the lake, they'll do whatever they want when they find it." "What are you suggesting?" Jake asked. "Bring the gold up ourselves? That's impossible." "We don't have to bring it up," Nick said. "We just have to find it. Take photos. Send word to every news service. Let everyone in the world know what's down there." "I've done a little diving in the Caribbean," Quentin said. "But this is a serious technical mission you're talking about. We don't have the gear, even if we were crazy enough to try it." "Scuba gear." Duckworth had just come back from the cockpit to catch the end of the conversation. "Oh, I can probably scare up something by the time we're on the ground." "I haven't been under 60 meters in a long time," Jake said, "but I'm up for it. Fortunately, we have one of the best divers I've ever known here on this plane." They all looked at Kate. She smiled and nodded, already getting herself psyched up for the greatest dive of her life. They landed in Salzburg, Austria. They had to wait for an hour on the ground while one of Duckworth's contacts rounded up the necessary scuba gear and delivered it to them. "I don't like this waiting," Nick said. "Who knows how long it'll take Agar to get here." When they finally had the gear they needed, they started driving east, with the professor and Duckworth along. It was now a team of six. This time, it really did feel like the last leg of the journey. 90 kilometers on the winding roads that led into the heavy forests of the Austrian Alps. One more time into the mountains. But this time the mission would end up underwater. They couldn't imagine the existence of another clue that would lead them anywhere else. "They call these the Todesgebirge," Lewis said as the vehicle started to climb. "The Dead Mountains. Did you know there's no oxygen in this lake under 20 meters? "Doesn't matter," Kate said, "as long as you have your own air strapped to your back." "If it's all right with everyone," Lewis said, I think I'd like to write a book about this adventure when it's all done. My last book was a survey of Minnesänga lyric poetry in the 12th to 14th centuries. I think this one might sell a few more copies. Can't wait to read it, Kate said. Especially the happy ending, Nick said, where we find the gold and get medals of honor and go on talk shows. I know you're going to, Lewis said. All of those things and more. I can feel it in my bones. When they arrived in the Salzkammergut Lake District, they parked the vehicle in the area between the two largest lakes, Grundlsee to the west and Toplitzsee, as it was called locally, to the east. They put on their wetsuits, because regardless of the surface temperature, it would be dangerously cold when they reached the lower depths of the lake. They slung everything else over their shoulders and started walking. Duckworth and the professor came along. No matter how dangerous this last mission might turn out to be, Kate felt no nerves at all, because today she would be going into the water, not into the air. In her brief history as a SEAL, it was the diving that had come most naturally to her. No matter how much noise and chaos were taking place above the surface, as soon as she rolled over the edge of that boat and plunged into the water, it was like a return to her own private sanctuary, a place of peace and utter silence. It had been a while since Kate had been back to that place, but as she walked down the forest road, air tank on her back, she could already feel the same sense of calm settling over her. The lake was a mile-long oval, just over 1,000 feet across at its widest, nestled between the high cliffs of the Totesgebirge. "The deepest part of the lake is on the eastern end," Lewis said. "The tiefest part of the Brunnen. I'd say that's your best place to start." The equipment was already getting heavy after they had walked a mile, but they summoned their second wind and hiked around the rough path that led to the opposite end of the lake. When they reached a small clearing, they put down their equipment, caught their breath, and got ready to dive. "I don't see anyone," Nick said, surveying the stone cliffs and trees that surrounded the lake. "Did we actually beat him here this time?" "We still have to be careful," Kate said. "We thought the same thing when we found the tunnel." "Quentin and Nick," Jake said, "go down as deep as you're comfortable. But I wouldn't recommend anything over 60 meters. If you see something interesting, let us know and we'll go deeper." "Same for you, Dad," Kate said. "If it's under 60, give me the sign." He was about to argue, but Kate cut him off. She was the dive master. She was the boss. Kate put on her buoyancy control vest, then her flippers. Finally, she put her mask over her face. It was a modern low-volume mask, not the old-school cylinder type she preferred, but she'd manage. The foursome waded out into the water, each one of them with underwater lanterns strapped to their wrists to help them see in the inky depths, along with a waterproof camera attached to a lanyard. Even with the wetsuits, the water was an icy shock. But the suits would let their bodies warm up quickly and keep their body heat from escaping. Kate put her respirator in her mouth and submerged, then lifted her mask and blew out air to clear it. She swam out several yards, watching the floor of the lake quickly drop below her. She let air out of her vest to become heavier, then started to sink, holding her nose and blowing out through her ears to equalize the pressure. She saw a few fish swimming around near the surface, but nothing when she got below 20 meters, where the water became starved of oxygen. A few more meters and the sunlight faded into a distant memory. She turned on her lantern. The sense of peace and calm she was expecting somehow didn't come to her. Instead, she felt a strange sense of eerie disquiet, as if, for the first time in her life as a diver, this underwater world did not welcome her. Kate looked around for the other three divers and saw faint glows in the distance, all slightly above her own depth. Kate looked at the gauge on her wrist. She was just shy of 60 meters. If anyone was going deeper, it would be her. She steeled herself, put her head down, and kicked with her flippers, clearing her ears as fast as she could. The water became darker and colder, until the beam from her light reached barely 3 feet in front of her. Finally, something emerged in Kate's vision. With one more kick, she leveled off just above it, shining her light on its contours. It was a huge log, slowly disintegrating in the water. Next to it was another log, then another, randomly crisscrossed over each other. She tried to shine her wrist lantern through the gaps, peering through to see if there was anything underneath this layer other than the rocky bottom floor of the lake itself. She gave another kick to move laterally over the layer of logs, but still couldn't see past them. "Slow down," she told herself. "Don't kick up sediment, or it'll be even harder to see down here." The strange, eerie feeling was growing stronger inside her. As she continued to move laterally, she sensed something vertical that was about to stop her. It was a wall of rock, like an underwater cliff. She moved along its face, wondering how high it was. There was no way to see. But then, just as she was deciding whether to retreat and continue scanning the logs, or to rise up along the wall, she saw something else. There was an opening in the layer of logs that otherwise acted like an impenetrable barrier to the lower depths. She paused for a few seconds, staying at neutral buoyancy. Then she made up her mind and let up more air to descend through the opening. She followed along the wall of the cliff until the surface of the rock abruptly ended. As she drifted down a few more meters, clearing her ears, she realized that she had found the entrance to an underwater cave. It wasn't the first time she'd seen one, not by a long shot. The first time she'd ever ventured into a cave, it was only 20 meters down, on one of her very first dives. But she remembered the feeling of claustrophobia when she went inside and lost visual contact with the surface. She'd dealt with it then. She would deal with a different underwater cave now. They found $7 million worth of gold in that underwater cave in the Catskills, she thought. Is it possible this cave could hold a lot more? With the almost useless lantern on her wrist shining in front of her, she advanced slowly into the cave. She knew she had to be careful. "Keep your sense of direction," she reminded herself, playing back her first dive master's instructions in her head. "Know exactly where you came in, exactly how to get yourself back out, even if you're blindfolded, which is essentially what you are right now." Kate didn't see any contours emerging. No floor, ceiling, or walls. She had no idea how big the space was, until finally she saw something just above her. She moved up slowly, saw dull metal. She moved her light closer and saw something even more unexpected. On the metal surface was a symbol. Just a few days ago, it would have meant nothing to her. But now she recognized the single vertical line with two smaller lines angling off it on one side. It was the same symbol she'd found in the tunnels, the symbol that made her decide to go right instead of left. She even remembered the name, Fehu, the symbol for wealth. "I found it," she thought. "I think I just found the gold." But then two more thoughts came to her. First, this dull metal object shaped like a barrel obviously wasn't gold. Was the gold stored inside it? If so, there must be 1,000 other barrels down here. Then the second thought, a small one but something that ran a chill down Kate's wetsuit. Why is this Fehu rune upside down? She moved the light above the barrel, saw the links of a chain attached to the top. It went up to a point somewhere above her, apparently holding the barrel in place. She moved to her left, came upon another barrel, another chain, and another upside-down Fehu rune. The chill in her wetsuit turned into a full Arctic cold front. "These aren't barrels of gold," she said to herself. "They look more like depth charges." She willed herself to remain totally calm and in control. The first rule of handling any crisis underwater. As she turned to leave, a hand grabbed her arm. She whirled around, expecting to see her father. But Kate didn't recognize the wetsuit. She shined her light through the other diver's mask, into the ice blue eyes of Klaus Agar. This was the man who had sent an army of hired soldiers to chase them across Europe. This was the man who would have let his soldiers do unspeakable things to her in the desert. Now she was alone with him in an underwater cave, and Kate felt nothing but a calm resolve. "You don't have your gun," Kate thought. "You don't have any leverage to use your size or strength. You're in my world now." Agar drew out a large diving knife, a thick 8-inch blade that on land would have struck fear into anyone on the wrong end of it. Down here, it was just a great way for Kate to concentrate her attention on what was coming next. Agar drove the knife forward, his movement so slow in the water that she easily avoided the blade, grabbing his wrist and turning it. With the bubbles streaming furiously from his respirator, the blade fell from his hand. She gave him a little come-hither gesture with her fingers, like, "Bring it on. Give me your next move." All of Kate's training came back to her in an instant, her underwater combat instructor's words ringing in her ears. "Your attacker is going to go for the easy targets. Your mask, your respirator. When he does that, you're going to stay calm. And then you're going to win the fight." Agar did exactly as she expected, reaching for her mask and ripping it from her face, then grabbing a respirator. She let him have both. Kate was blind now and unable to breathe. But that was temporary. She stayed close to him, slid around to his side, and turned off his tank. It took him a few seconds to realize what had happened. As his eyes went wide and he gasped on his respirator, Kate calmly put her own respirator back in her mouth, cleared her mask, and put it on her face. She watched Agar as he went into a full panic, deflecting his grasping hands as he clawed at her. Another diver appeared into the cave. He was about to go for Kate, but she pointed at Agar and he quickly realigned his priorities. He swam by her, took out his respirator to give to Agar. On his way past, she reached over and turned off his tank, too. The two men were wildly flailing at each other's tanks now, and as they jostled against the depth charges, Kate knew that she suddenly had a much bigger problem. She shot out of the cave, driving herself forward with her flippers. Before she could reach the entrance, she saw two more divers appear in the glow of her lantern. They were fighting each other, in a swirl of bubbles and stirred up sediment that made it impossible to tell one from the other. As the water cleared, Kate recognized her father's wetsuit. He had the other diver wrapped up tight, his forearm locked across the man's throat. She recognized the old school maneuver, a chokeout with pressure against the carotid artery. On land, it leaves your opponent lying on the mat. 60 meters underwater, it's fatal. As Jake released the other diver, Kate gave him an emphatic thumbs-up sign. In scuba language, that doesn't mean okay. It means get to the surface right now. Together they broke every rule on the way back to the surface. Come up slow, no faster than your smallest bubbles. Wait at 10 meters to decompress, unless you really are determined to get decompression sickness, aka the dreaded bends. Kate put two fingers to her mask, letting Jake know that they had to find Nick and Quentin as quickly as possible. When they separated, Kate turned in the direction where she had last seen Nick, finally seeing the glowing light. She had to descend again to grab him, and she gave him the same signal to get to the surface immediately. That left Quentin. When she broke to the surface and tore off her mask, Nick was there waiting for her, a few yards away. "Where's your father?" she yelled to them. "There," Nick yelled back. She looked over and saw her father helping Quentin out of the water. Quentin was coughing and spitting out water. "We have to get out," Kate yelled to Nick, and then she kicked frantically, driving herself faster than any swimmer could ever go without flippers. They both arrived at the shoreline together, and Jake pulled them out. "What the hell's going on?" Jake asked. She was still struggling to get her breath back when the explosion went off in the cave. It was an incredible sound, somehow muffled and deafening at the same time. There was an eruption of water directly over the cave. A few seconds later, the first dead fish floated to the surface, followed by another, and another, until there were at least 100 they could see, because according to the basic physics of a depth charge, water cannot be compressed, but the hydraulic shock it creates will compress anything with air in it, like the hollow shell of a submarine, or a lung with air in it, whether fish or human. Kate waited to see if Edgar or one of his men would also float to the surface. She wasn't surprised when they didn't, because a diver panicking inside a dark underwater cave has little chance of getting out, and the third diver her father choked out had no chance at all. "Are you telling me there were depth charges down there?" Jake asked. "That is what I am telling you," Kate said. As she glanced behind her, she saw yet another of Edgar's men, lying with his face on the ground and Duckworth's foot on his back. "This one tried to detain the professor and me," Duckworth said. "It didn't go so well for him." They all walked back up the trail together, lugging their tanks, nobody saying a word. The four divers dried off as well as they could. Then they all got in the vehicle and just sat there for a while in total silence. "If the gold was really down there," Kate said, "then it's buried under tons of rock at the bottom of the lake now." "This isn't the ending you wanted for your book," Nick said to the professor. Lewis shook his head. "I can't believe it's all over. Why am I supposed to just go back and teach my classes now? What do I tell the dean when he asks what I did on my unannounced vacation?" "And what do I tell Jessup," Kate thought, "when I fly back to Los Angeles and both of us have to face the deputy director? I know we broke into a half dozen landmarks all over Europe, sir, but the gold is down there somewhere, we promise." Jake started up the vehicle, put it in gear, and pulled out onto the road. "Hey, we all got out," Quentin said, "and Edgar didn't. I call that a success." "Damn straight," Jake said. "You actually saw depth charges down there," Quentin said, turning to look over the seat at Kate. "You must have been scared out of your head." "You could say that, yes." "Extraordinary." "They had the Fehu rune on them," she said. "Can you believe that?" "Pardon," Lewis said. "Are you saying that the depth charges had a Fehu rune printed on them?" "Printed? Drawn? Whatever it was." "I find that quite twisted," Lewis said. Another minute passed. "The runes were upside down," Kate said. "Pardon again?" Lewis asked. "The runes," she said to the professor. "They were drawn upside down. On both depth charges I saw." The professor's mind was churning. "Is that significant?" she asked. "When a rune is upside down, the meaning is reversed. Up becomes down. Love becomes hate. In this case, wealth becomes..." He paused to think about it. "Wealth becomes greed. It becomes slavery to the pursuit of wealth, instead of the value of the wealth itself." The words hung in the air. Nobody knew quite what they meant. "So it was like a final message," Kate said. "Here's your reward for being so greedy, for chasing wealth all the way down to the bottom of a lake." "I suppose that's the best way to look at it," Lewis said. "What a strange message to send to someone who at that point is about to die. But it must have felt poetic to whoever set that trap. And perhaps for us, it's just as fitting a note to end on." Jake kept driving. Everyone stayed lost somewhere deep in their own thoughts. "Professor," Kate said, "do you remember when you told us to not let you overthink things next time?"
"I do remember that, yes."
"I'm just thinking out loud here," Kate said, "and feel free to tell me I'm completely off base, but tell me again. Why did you call the lake Goering's Deep Well?"
"Because he had a villa overlooking it, and this lake is about as deep a well as you can find."
"Okay, well, I get that," she said. "But what if the lake was just a misdirection, a death trap meant to catch anyone who came looking for the gold?
like you said, a poetic message to someone who was about to die because of their own greed.
I don't understand, Lewis said. What are you asking me?
I'm just saying, this villa of his. Another long pause. Wouldn't it have had an actual well on the property? Don't you think? 3 seconds later, the vehicle skidded to a stop, did a quick U-turn, and then kicked up gravel with its squealing tires as it headed back toward the lake.